Please.
Thank you very much. And first of all, thank you very much to the organizers of this meeting for inviting me to this beautiful place. But I have to say, I haven't yet provided the photographic opportunities of my last trip, which was to South Africa. The headlines say that Comet Pan-STARRS is lighting up the northern skies. So I was, and that was a brilliant piece of organization on the part of the organizers of this meeting, but I have to say that so far it hasn't quite provided me with the opportunities that South Africa did, which were things like this. This was a few days after the meeting in near Kruger National Park. Anyway, today I want to talk about magneto association to form molecules that have both electron and magnetic, electric and magnetic moments. And for me, that's going to mean molecules like strontium rubidium or ytterbium rubidium. But first of all, I just want to ground us in the alkali dimers in order to explain why the molecules I'm talking about today are a bit different. So Jun Yi and others have done wonderful work making alkali dimers by magneto association. And the basic process is that you have an atomic state, which is red here, crossing a molecular state, which is blue, and you prepare a cloud, doesn't have to be a BEC, just on the side of the crossing where the atomic state is the lowest. And then because it's an avoided crossing, you can tune a magnetic field over it adiabatically. I'm having problems with my to form molecules. So that occurs, and that's what's usually called tuning adiabatically over a Feshbach resonance, but of course this is a Feshbach resonance in magnetic field space by contrast with the things that David Nesbitt told us about yesterday, which were Feshbach resonances in energy space. The great thing about magneto association is that it makes all the molecules in a single state, so it's a really good starting point for STIRAP to reach the absolute ground state. Now, one problem, if you like to put it that way, with the alkali metal dimers is that they all have singlet ground states, so they have no electron spin in the states that have decent dipole moments. So there's a lot of interest in extending magneto association to molecules that would have electron spin as well as magnetic dipoles. And good candidates for that are things where you take where one of the atoms is an alkali metal and the other is a closed shell species. And that typically means either one of the group 1b elements or ytterbium or possibly even mercury. When you're making alkali dimers, then you've got a complicated pattern of energy levels that sit a little bit below threshold, and this is the case of rubidium 87 with cesium. There's actually one more level at about 100 kilohertz that you can't quite see on this scale. But we have this complicated pattern of levels crossing and avoided crossing one another and crossing and avoided crossing with the atomic threshold. This shows the scattering length. And you can see that there's a resonance, a pole in the scattering length, everywhere that one of these bound states crosses the threshold. Now, in the alkali metals, of course, all of them, oddly enough, have non-zero nuclear spin, and they've all got spin a half. So we've always got two atomic states in zero field, with total angular momentum I is plus a half or minus a half. When you apply magnetic fields, those split. But the key thing about the alkali dimers, really, is that when you bring together two alkali atoms in doublet S states, you end up with singlet and triplet curves, and they're extremely different, or at least they're different, is what's key. The singlet state typically has a depth of a few thousand wave numbers. The triplet state typically has a depth of a few hundred wave numbers. And it's quite largely the difference between those two curves that is responsible for the coupling between the molecular states and the atomic states. So we can write down a collision Hamiltonian. It's got kinetic energy, it's got atomic hyperfine terms, it's got Zeeman terms, and it's got these two potential terms in it, V0 for the singlet and V1 for the triplet. But the point is that that Hamiltonian basically couples everything in sight. And so you do really get a decent crossing everywhere that any atomic state, any molecular state, crosses the atomic threshold, provided it has the right total angular momentum. Because the atomic and molecular states have different characters, they have different magnetic moments, and so you can tune one across the other. So you get loads of Feshbach resonances because they cross and they couple. But both the crossing and the coupling are essential. Now, mostly I want to talk today about the systems, but because in theory this is a theoretical program, I'm going to say a little bit about the actual calculations we do and then move quickly on to the systems. So what we need to do with theory is to provide potential energy curves or models of some kind that reproduce the energy levels so that we can understand where all these crossings between the levels and between the levels and the thresholds are to enable control in the experiments. Now, if you've got two alkali metal atoms, there are actually five sources of angular momentum in the system. There's two electron spins, two nuclear spins, and an end-over-end angular momentum of the two things about one another. And there are a hell of a lot of ways that you can couple together five angular momenta to get any given resultant. So, unfortunately, in free space, the total angular momentum is conserved, but in a magnetic field, and we're always interested in magnetic fields, the only thing that's conserved is the projection of the total angular momentum onto the field axis. So you end up constructing quite big basis sets of all these angular momentum functions in order to span the space that you need. And the whole thing is a function of the interatomic distance. So basically, we've got a large matrix or coupled equation problem that comes from this. Now, the homonuclear dimers are actually a special case because there are some nearly conserved quantum numbers, but the heteronuclear dimers don't have this advantage. So near-avoided crossings in the homonuclear dimers and everywhere in the heteronuclear dimers, you need fairly big basis sets of spin functions. Cesium dimer, about 200. Actually, in the systems I'm talking about today, many, many fewer because we don't have that many angular momenta, but still a significant number to couple together. So what we actually do is that we take that angular momentum basis set, we plug it into the Schrödinger equation, and that gives us a set of coupled ordinary differential equations for the components of the wave function in each of these channels, which are J and K here, the different angular momentum channels. But the whole thing is a function of R. If we're doing scattering, then what we do is simply propagate this set of coupled equations from short range to long range, match the Bessel functions, do all the normal scattering stuff, pull out an S matrix. We like to define an energy or wave number dependent scattering length just through this nice simple equation. And we use a package called MolSCAT, which I'm the main author of, but it's nice. One of the nice things about MolSCAT is that it'll converge on poles and zeros in the scattering length. You don't actually have to fit. If we're doing bound state calculations, we use almost exactly the same technology. Except the only difference is that we propagate our coupled equations from long and short range into the middle, and there we match and calculate some matching matrices, and that allows us to converge on eigenvalues of the bound state problem. The propagation method has some quite big advantages for those bound states because, first of all, it doesn't go as the cube of some radial basis set. It goes linear in the number of steps, and that's a big advantage. We can propagate extremely cheaply to tens or hundreds of thousands of Bohr because we use very long step sizes at long range with propagators based on Airy functions. And the net effect, this is from some recent work on cesium dimer with Paul Julian and the Innsbruck group, but we have no trouble finding bound states that are within a few kilohertz of dissociation. Now, actually, bound and MOSGAT are pretty general programs. They came out of the atom molecule scattering world and got adapted to the stuff needed for the cold world and magnetic fields. But they also, one nice thing about them is that it's really easy to plug in a new scattering system into them, plug a new set of angular momentum algebra for a new problem into them. So, okay, that's enough on methods. Let me get on with talking about molecules. Although I do have another of these pictures to show you. This is actually a picture of me. It's a picture of me when I got to the airport on the way here. And was told that my flight was delayed for 4 hours and I was going to miss my transatlantic connection. Okay, so what is it that's different about the alkali systems with singlet S atoms? Well, the first thing that's different is that there's only one potential curve. If it's doublet S and singlet S, the only thing you can do, guess if you bring them together, is a doublet sigma curve. And here's what that curve looks like for a set of the different ytterbium systems. I'm afraid they're in Hartrees, so multiply by 200,000 to get wave numbers, or 300,000 to get Kelvin. But they're a few hundred wave numbers deep, basically. They don't really matter much except that we can get them. The Hamiltonian's a bit simpler because, and at first sight at least, it would be this. We've only got one potential curve. We've only got one atom normally, because we'll start by talking about spin zero ytterbium or strontium. We've only got one atom that's got nuclear spin, so we've only got one hyperfine interaction. Now, the consequence of this is that when you start drawing the curves that correlate with different atomic states, different atomic hyperfine states, they're almost exactly parallel to one another and just shifted by the atomic hyperfine energy. What that means is that although here shown in black is the familiar diagram for what happens to, in this particular case, it's cesium, what happens to the energy levels of a cesium atom in magnetic field, the Bright-Rabi diagram. And shown below it are the set of molecular states that are based around this upper threshold. But each set is completely parallel to the set above it. So, at first sight, this is good because we do have crossings between states that go up from this threshold and states that come down from this. So this is a molecular state tied to the atomic threshold going upwards, and this is the lower atomic threshold coming down. And we do have crossings where these black spots are, where in principle you might get Feshbach resonances. The problem is that because everything's parallel here, and there's nothing in this Hamiltonian that couples the molecular states to the atomic states, at first sight, these don't actually give Feshbach resonances, or at least they give zero width Feshbach resonances, which are probably not a lot of good. So fortunately, that's an oversimplification. And what I want to do now is explain why it's an oversimplification. So what is it that makes magneto-association allowed in these systems? What is there in the collision Hamiltonian that can couple these states? Unfortunately, this atomic hyperfine plus Zeeman term doesn't do it because the atoms are eigenstates of that thing. So no matter what the field is, the atomic eigenstates are eigenfunctions of that. So are the molecular eigenstates, no coupling. Fortunately, if this thing is independent of distance, there's no coupling. Fortunately, it's not quite independent of distance. That thing is the atomic hyperfine coupling constant. If you take a rubidium atom, say, and you bring a strontium atom, say, up to it, that hyperfine coupling is going to change a bit. So the key question is, how much does it change? Well, this shows the hyperfine, is this the hyperfine coupling or the hyperfine splitting? It's 87, so it's the hyperfine coupling constant. This shows that as a function of distance. And you can see it's varying by maybe 20% of its value across the important range of molecular distances, but a fairly short range in the molecule. So that provides a coupling. that does mix the atomic and molecular states, and so is going to make these Feshbach resonances of non-zero width, but we don't yet know how big. So we started out with this 2 or 3 years ago, but a key thing here is that something we don't know before we start is we don't know the scattering lengths. And no potential curve that we get from electronic structure calculations is going to be good enough to tell us the scattering lengths. So we actually don't know where these, although we know a lot about the pattern of these bound state levels, we don't know where the top one lies. So in order to pin us to reality, we need a measurement of one scattering length for one isotopic species or one binding energy for one isotopic species that'll pin us down. Once we've got that, the ab initio potentials are good enough to tell us how things will scale with mass as we change the mass of the ytterbium or strontium or whatever. So this is a typical example, and this is actually for the case of rubidium 87 with various different isotopes of ytterbium. And this is based on binding energies that Axel Görlitz's group has measured for a few of these different species. So in other words, this is the one case where we do know where those levels lie with respect to the thresholds. And what you can see is happening here is that this one's ytterbium 168. If we change the ytterbium isotope, we change the reduced mass, so everything slides down the well. So we actually get quite a lot of tuning and quite a lot of choice of where the field of the fields at which these crossings occur by tuning the mass of the ytterbium or strontium isotope. If you look at these, they're somewhat uncomfortable fields. These ones, for example, go up to about 5,000 Gauss, the lowest crossings. They creep in to 1,000 Gauss or so. But what we can get from a measurement of the scattering length is, roughly speaking, the positions of these resonances. What we can't yet get is the widths. If we want to switch for rubidium 87 for rubidium 85, that's dead easy. But what are the widths? You jamming this. I have to get very close. So, 2 or 3 years ago, we had approached this problem for rubidium strontium because Florian Schreck asked us about it. And we did close couple calculations. And for plausible potentials, remember, not real potentials because we didn't have those crucial measurements of a binding energy, but for plausible potentials, we got resonance widths that covered an enormous range. Some of them went up as high as 100 milligauss. Some of them were as tiny as 0.3 microgauss. And the fields at which they happened went from a few gauss up to 5,000. Now, those numbers are right. There's nothing wrong with those numbers. But frankly, at the time, we didn't understand what it was that was determining those numbers. So what we've now done is to understand are what they are, and understand what you would need to, how you go about choosing ones that have the right properties. So we've now got a model based on the Fermi Golden Rule, and the Golden Rule, when it's giving you a width in energy space, just says that the width is proportional to the square of some kind of integral of a perturbation between your bound state and the continuum state it's coupling to. When you do the jiggery pokery involving magnetic moments and things and quantum defect theory and stuff, in order to translate that into a magnetic field width of the type that people would be interested in here, you can decompose this into a series of terms, and I'm going to say what each of these terms is in a minute, but this thing is something that depends only on the magnetic field for a particular alkali metal atom. This is a radial integral of some kind or another, and then we've got the background scattering length coming in over here, and this thing is the, well, it says, wow. This thing is the rate at which the bound state crosses threshold. I want to, and the key things really are these, so I want to break down where those come from in the molecular physics. Come on, talk to me. Your keyboard. So the first bit, here's the same equation, and I'm now just focusing on this atomic bit. This is the matrix element of the hyperfine coupling between the two atomic states of the same, with the same projection of the atomic quantum number. The trouble with this is that when you're at zero field, these atomic states are actually eigenfunctions of that operator. So the matrix elements are zero at zero field. When you get to high field, they're just matrix elements of I plus S minus. So they drop out with standard well-known expressions involving involving raising and lowering operators. So at high field, these matrix elements level off. And in between, they do, well, they do this. And these are easily calculated things. But the key thing really, this is at, this particular one is for cesium. The key thing really is that this matrix element is linear in B for the first couple of thousand Gauss. That means that the width is going to be quadratic in B for the first couple of thousand Gauss. This means that resonances in the low field region where most people would like to work, i.e. below 1,000 Gauss, tend to be very, very narrow. So the consequence of this experiment is that although low field crossings exist, they give frighteningly narrow resonances, and I'll come on to what that means in quantitative terms in a minute. The other thing is that actually the high spin alkali metals have considerable advantages over the low spin ones, just because of this, you know, I into I plus one term in the matrix element, and of course because zeta itself, the coupling constant itself is larger for the heavier alkalis. There's also this bit, and this is basically the matrix element involving the radial functions for the bound state and the continuum state. So what I've shown here, this is, again is the case of cesium ytterbium. But here I've shown a bound state wave function just below threshold. And, you know, it's got quite a lot of oscillations, but by far, you know, usual shape. This is the zero energy continuum function. And this is what that matrix element that's of the thing that's doing the perturbation, the change in the hyperfine with distance, looks like. So when we take the product of those three, when we take the product of those three, actually these two are at such similar energies that they stay in phase with one another across pretty much the whole of the well. So the product of them is a function that's pretty much positive anywhere, everywhere. Well, negative everywhere, the way I've drawn it there. And then when we multiply it by that, we get a function that looks like this. And this is how the integrand develops across the range. But you can see that basically this is an integral that comes somewhere from the inner turning point, and it's finished by the time you get to 20 Bohr of distance. This is a short-range coupling. Now, this quantity delta zeta is, of course, it's roughly speaking, it's 20% of the value of zeta in all the systems we've looked at. This is what it is for ytterbium with lots of different alkali metals. So because of that, the heavier alkali metals give you greater widths than the light alkali metals. Now, there are one or two other factors that are worth considering. To do with selecting between ytterbium or strontium isotopes you want to move. The first thing is that although this expression at first sight looks as though it's got a 1 over delta, a 1 over background scattering length in it, actually picking an isotope that has a near zero background scattering length is not a particularly good thing to do, because a background times delta is a more realistic measure of the strength of the coupling than a background itself. On the other hand, when the background scattering length is large, we actually have a term that comes from the normalization of the continuum wave functions that looks like this. And the overall consequence is that when A background is large, the scattering length comes out being proportional to the background scattering. Sorry, the width comes out being proportional to the background scattering length. Here are some actual numbers, again, for various different resonances in cesium ytterbium. Not quite sure what happened to the B there. But you can see that this shows the scattering lengths, and they're basically increasing usefully at large background scattering length, both positive and negative. The big spike in the middle isn't a lot of help because that's just from the 1 upon A background. But there are some other spikes in here. There's a spike here, for example, which is not at zero, and a spike here, which is not at zero, which you might get if you're lucky. And those basically come, oh gosh, that one hasn't come through very well. Those basically come under these circumstances where a bound state of from this threshold kind of just kisses the corresponding state here. We have a double crossing where the relative slope is getting very small. When the relative slope of the two, energy as a function of field, is small, then that's in the denominator of the width and we get wide resonances. Now you've got to hit it fairly lucky to get that effect. There may be one isotope that does it in a particular system. So, that's basically the story for the bosonic isotopes of ytterbium. If we look for a minute at the fermionic isotopes in ytterbium, Deep Gupta and Yoshiro Takahashi are looking at lithium with ytterbium. The scattering length has been measured to be, well, depending which group you believe, somewhere near 8 angstroms, but the sign is not known. For all the reasons that I've said, the widths are absolutely tiny for the bosonic isotopes, a couple of microgauss. But there is something else that can happen if you go to a fermionic isotope of ytterbium. Because what's happening when you bring the two atoms together is really that some spin is being transferred from the alkali to the closed shell atom. So if the closed shell atom itself has a nuclear magnetic moment, those can interact, and you get a new kind of hyperfine coupling in the molecule that didn't exist in the free atoms. And since ytterbium has a much bigger nuclear magnetic moment than lithium, this gives you much bigger couplings. And it gives you couplings at slightly different places because the selection rules that govern those couplings are different. So here's one of those diagrams for lithium thresholds coming down and molecular levels going up. If we blow up this little region, we actually have a network of crossings where Feshbach resonances can occur. And the little black dots, the aware of the resonances can happen for the bosonic isotopes, and those are tiny widths, but you get rather better resonances at these open circles, and, well, they're still less than a milligauss. But they are better. So this is a mechanism that might give you something observable in the lithium ytterbium. It does not give you anything enormously different from the alkali-based resonances in the heavier alkali atoms. It's really just that the lithium is tiny rather than that ytterbium is big. This is my skeptical look when they told me that they'd found a flight that was actually going to connect through to the US. I'm going to skip the thing I thought I might talk about on conical intersections. That was just in case I ended up in the unlikely event that I ended up with spare time. So I'm going to move swiftly on to conclusions. So we know that magneto-association has already produced wonderful results in the alkali dimers from many different groups, and combining it with stirrup has been done in CIRAP has been done in Gila and Innsbruck. We think that that's going to be possible for these other species, the alkali metals with ytterbium or strontium or similar. But they do happen at quite high fields and need very detailed field control. The widest resonances happen at the higher fields, And the chances of having anything below 1,000 Gauss that's much good, I'm afraid, is fairly small. You're going to need to have very careful choice of which isotope you look for in a particular system in order to get decent resonances. And before you can choose your isotope, you need really one measurement of a binding energy from two-photon photoassociation or similar near threshold for any isotope, not necessarily for the good one. We can do the mass scaling. I didn't talk about conical intersections. And I will just mention some of the other stuff that we're working on, or at least flash it up. Things like sympathetic cooling and molecular MQDT and all sorts of molecule formation and Feshbach resonance things. Mostly, I'd like to thank the people involved in this. Most of the work I've talked about today was done by Daniel Brew, a postdoc who's actually just left my group. But it was started by Jesus Aldegonda and Piotr Zhukovsky on the rubidium strontium work a few years ago. Other people in my group, I collaborate a lot with Paul Julian, although not actually on this particular project. I'm really very grateful to all the experimentalists who keep me in line and tell me what we really ought to be calculating and what the interesting things are. And I talk to all these people quite a lot whenever I have the chance, and those are really fruitful collaborations. And finally, this is how I felt when I finally got to Santa Barbara.
Thank you, Jeremy, for this very illuminating talk. Are there questions?
Yeah, so I have a question on the figure that you showed, which you said was about cesium, where the coupling matrix element is growing stronger for higher fields. Maybe you can show that figure, if possible.
The one showing the widths?
Yeah, I think it was a coupling matrix element.
Okay, so that was showing the widths, but yeah. The coupling...
Yeah.
That one?
No, I think even a bit before.
That one?
Yes, that one. Yeah, that is about cesium.
That particular one's for cesium.
The cesium.
Okay. That's actually for a cesium atom. Cesium with anything, but particularly with one of these.
Okay. Yeah, just for one atom.
So that's purely the matrix element of the I dot S between different MF states of cesium, but it applies to the molecule of cesium with any closed shell atom.
I maybe misunderstood, because I was wondering about the following. If you look, for instance, at cesium, the alkali, then you know that when you go to higher magnetic fields, and then also the nuclear spin and electron spin, they become good quantum numbers.
Okay, and that's precisely what's happening here, is that at sufficiently high field, MI and MS have become quantum numbers, good quantum numbers, and that's the regime in which it goes to this limit, which is given by a matrix element of I plus and S minus between those good quantum numbers, MS and MI.
Yeah.
But you have to get to pretty high fields before you actually tail off to that particular limit.
Yeah. But what also happens is that then the molecular potentials and the atomic eigenstates, they all get the same slopes. Huh? So that means that there you will not expect to have any Feshbach resonance anymore.
Okay,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, Jeremy, I'd like to support what Christian said. It's really a great talk, very pedagogical and so on. But I suspect that if you made the conical intersection just on the line, it's because maybe you would like to talk, or at least I'd like to talk to hear a little bit more about that, even if it's not fair, because it means that you would have an extra time for your talk, right? But could you, in a couple of minutes, just say, okay, what is the purpose there? Because it looks like it's a very, I mean, if you get the authorization by Lincoln or so, if they allow that.
Two minute version?
Two minutes.
Okay, right.
Just to get the main message.
But Olivier, you give away up the microphone.
Right.
You need to find the right place to be. Okay, so the big deal here is that in molecules, you can have states of different parity which are quite close to one another. And so you can tune two molecular states of different parity across one another with a magnetic field. And in zero electric field, those states can cross. But if you apply an electric field, it'll mix the states of opposite parity, and so they'll avoid it cross. The blue and the red are the zero electric field. The dashed black is what happens if you apply an electric field to it. So that means that you can create a conical intersection as a function of laboratory coordinates, x, y, and z in the lab. So what happens now, if that was all you had, then any molecules that you put in here would just slide off to plus or minus infinity. So if you wrap that in an optical potential, an optical trap, you can make it into something where the minimum is basically a ring running around the conical intersection. Now, so you could in principle load molecules into this ring and see what happens. And this happens for, this is for triplet KRB, these are quite reasonable fields. This is a 5-micron ring with sort of perfectly manageable electric and magnetic fields. So it looks like that, and you can load molecules into this torus at the bottom of it. But a conical intersection produces a Berry phase. So if you work out what the molecular eigenstates are and go all the way around once, they've changed sign by the time you get back to where you started from. What that does in molecular systems like lithium trimer is that it gives you half integer quantization of the angular momentum, because you've essentially got particle on a ring with twisted boundary conditions. And you get something very similar in the Gross-Pitiewski equation. And so in principle, we can get these half-integer quantizations in conical intersections that we build in lab space like that. We've actually got a variant on this that would work for atoms rather than molecules that involves microwave dressing in place of the electric field. So I think this is quite neat, but what the hell's it good for? 2 minute version.
Next question, Dave.
Yeah, so
I'd love to talk to anyone about this, by the way, but maybe not here.
Okay, hi, Jeremy, back here. So random comment, if you go back a couple of slides to where you had the opposite parity level crossings.
Yep.
I thought you might be amused to know that we use exactly those level crossings for our experiment to study parity violation. Turns out the electroweak interaction couples those two opposite parity states.
Okay.
And we've actually now done pretty extensive spectroscopy of these level crossings.
In which molecule?
In barium fluoride.
Okay.
But it's in a molecular beam, not
sure.
In...
And of course, Junyi's group uses almost exactly this to for their evaporative cooling of OH.
Yeah. So my question was, so for the magneto association, you really focused on this Fermi contact term and how it depends on the distance between the atoms as the way to couple the channels. But it seems like in principle there are other terms in the Hamiltonian, like a spin rotation coupling, and there's also anisotropic hyperfine.
Absolutely,
is that
included? we did think about them, but they are absolutely tiny. This effect is of the order in cesium dimer, 20% of 9 gigahertz is a couple of gigahertz. The other terms really are on the megahertz. Even the biggest of them is nuclear quadrupole coupling, but even that's on the megahertz level. So those terms exist, but they are absolutely tiny.
So you're saying in the cesium dimer, the Fermi contact term in the hyperfine changes by 20% for, let's say, the first bound state from the atoms?
Right? No, I'm saying that when you bring in a closed shell atom to cesium, then when you get to somewhere near the minimum of the chemical bond, the hyperfine coupling of cesium has changed by about 20%.
Yeah, I see.
So the maximum in the coupling as a function of in the change of the coupling as a function of distance is a couple of gigahertz.
Yeah. Right. Thanks.
Yeah, I just want to ask about this. How do you calculate it, and how do you know you have an accurate value of this R-dependent hyperfine?
Okay, so there's been a lot of work on, it's DFT, basically. And they're DFT calculations that are calibrated against known systems. But it's true that it's a bit of a leap of faith.
So in your conical, over here, Jeremy. In your conical intersection picture there, you asked about what you can do with the ring trap and having this pi phase. So if the mean field is tightly enough constrained to be quasi 1D, then you get self-induced phase slip, and you know that there are a number of unmeasured interesting theoretical possibilities in well-controlled ring traps. And I think you need a modified mean field equation because of this pi phase that you pick up automatically even when nothing's rotating. And I don't think anybody's written down that equation, for example. So there are several things to do there.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, Jeremy, can you make a sort of general comment on triplet alkali dimers versus the alkali group 2 dimers? They would both have both the electric for the heteronuclears, the
I think if you're putting
moments.
Them in lattices, they're great.
Right.
But they do have enough energy, even in their ground states, always to react, and they're liable to you know. So if they're spin polarized, then if you're lucky, they'll be colliding on a quintet surface. We've actually put a fair amount of thought, but
let's assume you have the triplets in V equals zero.
Yeah.
Already, okay.
The answer is that we haven't done any actual calculations on them,
right.
And I've given a little bit of thought to whether there's any real hope of those collisions being barrierless. The trouble the trouble is that these are, you know, 8,000 wave numbers above the singlet plus singlet.
Right,
so
right.
There's a hell of a lot of places they can go to if they can access the. Once they collide, there's a hell of a lot of places that in principle they can go to if the barriers don't stop them. We don't know whether there are barriers to stop them.
Jeremy, this R-dependent change in the hyperfine. Can I simply think about that as basically sort of incipient. Sort of spin delocalization on the ytterbium? Is that
you can, but it's happening in both directions. Electrons are moving to and fro.
Yeah.
But the net effect is a transfer of spin density.
So, would that picture allow us to have some intuition as to what you would imagine with other singlet S partners? I mean, in other words, has something to do with the strength of the chemical bonding interactions?
If we interpret in something like lithium ytterbium, if we interpret it, if we thought that it was simply that some spin density had moved from one nucleus to the other, we'd get, I don't know, it's better than order of magnitude, but not a factor of two, in how big the coupling due to the ytterbium would be. So it's a bit more complicated than that. But to some extent, yes. Once you have a feel for the bonding, it corresponds to a feel for the spin density transfer.
Thank you.
I may allow myself to ask a question. Yeah. Okay.
The lithium ytterbium, for example. I mean, that's going to, if those collide, they're going to make lithium 2 in ytterbium.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't understand your objection to the alkali triplets.
It's a valid point. No.
Okay.
Chris.
Yeah. As difficult as it seems to be to get broad von Fischbach resonances in these systems, I wonder if you could comment on it. It seems more promising to me to look at light-induced resonances.
Thanks for asking my question.
So I mean, in many ways, I think that's true. We've thought about all sorts of interactions like microwaves and stuff. And pretty much everything that happens in the ground state is dominated by our independent terms, which don't give you... which don't give you strong resonances. So the as you say, the advantage of coupling to an excited state is the excited state does have a completely different R dependence from the ground state, essentially, and so you can couple in some things which give you bigger couplings. So that is quite definitely another way to go.
Okay, final quick question by Conquin.
I guess I just wanted to make a comment about the triplet ground state molecule. Before we made the singlet Caribbean ground state molecule, we made the triplet row vibration ground state molecules. And we didn't spend very much time studying the lifetime, but the lifetime for the density that we had was extremely short, like hundreds of microseconds.
What sort of densities?
Oh, is that like 10 to the 12, yeah, 10 to the 12 per cubic centimeter.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Okay, then let's thank Jeremy again.